From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, members of the Electoral College, including 11 here in Boston, cast their votes for president and vice president as anti-Trump protesters gather outside the statehouse.
When they try to take our rights,
we won't go down without a fight.
The Electoral College, is this really the best way to elect a president? Also today, new research on the fading American dream, why it's harder than ever to earn more than your parents.
I think it's a dream, and I think it's going to be a very hard dream to make a reality. It's a lot more harder to reach that reality than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago.
And Shakespeare to hip-hop. The Boston Public Library salutes the bard and why he's still relevant.
If you cannot understand what I mean and declare it's Greek to me, you're quoting Shakespeare.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
It is only right that we consider the mind and the measure for measure of the Swan of Avon.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Well, it's Election Day when Americans choose a new president. A lot of us thought that's what we were doing on November 8th, but this year reminded us again that the Electoral College elects the president. And today in state capitals across the country, including right here in Boston, electors are now casting their votes for president and vice president. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by almost 3 million votes, but as we know, Donald Trump captured a majority of electoral votes and is poised to become the nation's 45th president, despite protests from his opponents urging electors to vote against him. But why do we elect our presidents this way? And given that this is the second time in the past 16 years that a president has been elected despite losing the popular vote, is it time to abolish the Electoral College? Alexander Kasar, professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, is working on a book exploring that very subject. He's also the author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, and he joins us now in the studio. And Alex Kasar, good to have you back.
It's a pleasure to be here, Anthony.
So let's talk about what's happening today. Usually the meeting of the Electoral College is a formality that doesn't get a whole lot of attention, but this year is different. There are protests, concerns about Russian hacking, calls to the electors that they vote their conscience rather than the way their state voted. Do you expect this year's Electoral College to go differently than in previous years in any way?
Well, I would expect that there might be a few electors who will vote for someone other than Donald Trump or who may cast protest votes of one sort or another. I do not expect that they will be sufficiently numerous to affect the outcome of the Electoral College vote. I think that Donald Trump will get a majority of the Electoral College vote, and those votes will be forwarded to Congress, and he will be president.
He'll be president. Now, you've written widely about the way our democracy works and in some cases, the way it doesn't work. So with that in mind, I'm wondering, can you just remind us and give us a brief history lesson here about why we have the Electoral College?
It is a very good question, and the answer is not that this was the long deliberated and carefully crafted product of the Founding Fathers' wisdom. At the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787, they had a lot of trouble figuring out how a president, a chief magistrate, should be elected. Or should be chosen, whether he should be elected at all, and if so, by whom. There's a lot of sentiment thinking that Congress should choose the president, and they kept deciding to do that, and then they kept saying, no, that's really a bad idea because there would be corruption and separation of powers. Hmm. But they couldn't come up with anything else that they thought was particularly good. And finally, at the end of the summer, I mean, it's a long, hot summer in Philadelphia. They've been there. They've been working for 3 months.
No air conditioning.
Very humid. So if you've ever spent the summer in Philadelphia, right. You know, it's, people who could afford to left Philadelphia during the summer. And they wanted to take a break. They had resolved a number of big issues, but they had not resolved this. So the bulk of the convention went away leaving the remaining things to be worked out by what was called a Committee on Unfinished Parts. And then, you know,
how to elect the president got delegated to the Committee on Unfinished Parts.
Exactly.
I love this.
The poor guys, one from each state, who had to stay in town while everybody else took a break. And it was this committee that came up with this idea. It was not anybody's first choice, but it was not anybody's last choice either. What the Electoral College was in that sense was it was a replica of Congress, you know, with the same number of representatives and as representatives and senators from each state, but it never legislated, so it got around the problem of corruption. And the convention reconvened. They tinkered with it a little bit, but it seemed good enough. But this was cobbled together in haste end of a long convention.
Would there have been at that moment a sort of understanding that it would be possible to have a president elected without the popular vote? I mean, was there some sort of democratic justification for that at the time, that, yes, this is a possibility, and here's why it's a possibility?
Well, there had been people at the convention, including James Madison, who had favored having a national popular vote. They thought that that was best, that it should rest with the people. But there were others who opposed that. And in fact, the provision of the Constitution as written and as it still stands leaves open the question of whether there has to be a popular vote. The Constitution says that electors shall be chosen in such manner as the legislature of each state shall determine. Where there is no constitutional mandate to have a popular election, many states chose electors without having a popular election, and they could still do that today.
Wow. Now, let me ask you about the question that has sort of been on a lot of people's minds today, and that is this idea that electors might choose, although it doesn't appear that that is happening in sufficient numbers to change the vote, but might choose to vote their conscience rather than the way their states voted. Are electors obligated by law, federal or state, to vote the way their state voted?
My answer to that would be effectively no, they are not obligated. The Constitution does not obligate them to do that. It does not envisage that. As originally written, they were supposed to deliberate and use their own wisdom and their own insights. That was the idea. They were not simply to be messengers. Very quickly, it became a system of they were just messengers, except for some rare exceptions. That was really true by the late 1790s. In terms of state obligations or state laws, a number of states have passed laws that in effect penalize or try to prohibit electors from voting for anyone other than the person that they are pledged to. My own view, and I think the view of most people who know this this terrain, is that those laws are not really enforceable, and they've never been tested in the courts.
Now, you've written widely about the need to reform or even do away with the Electoral College, and before you explain that, I want to play a piece of tape from President-elect Donald Trump, who at a rally in Mobile, Alabama on Saturday praised the Electoral College. And by the way, not long ago he was saying he wanted to do away with it. But here in Mobile, here he is praising it for making his campaign essentially move into areas of the country that might not see a presidential campaign. Here's what he said.
That's the beauty of this electoral system. You know, the other, if you go with like the popular vote, I'd go New York State, California, back, forth, back. It would be much easier. The problem is every other place. You'd stop in Florida, you'd stop in Texas, you wouldn't see any place else.
Isn't that actually a pretty good argument in favor of the Electoral College, in that it sort of forces the campaigns into parts of the country that aren't huge centers of population?
I don't think it's a good argument. What it does is to direct the campaigns into swing states.
Yes.
Which might be large centers of population or might not be, depending on the particular partisan configuration of the states. And what the other thing that the Electoral College does is that it focuses the campaign every cycle into a handful of states. The campaign happens in 8 to 10 states. If we had a national popular vote, a candidate would be looking for votes wherever he or she could get them. And, you know, if you could pick up extra votes by going to a small state or a medium-sized state, you would do that as well. So I don't think that that's an argument that really, when you probe it, when you look closely at it, carries much weight.
But wouldn't it, putting aside what we just heard Donald Trump saying, wouldn't it have to sort of focus the presidential elections where the biggest populations are. So in that sense, isn't he right? Wouldn't it just be an election for New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Dallas, I don't know, Miami?
I don't think so. Look, if you change the electoral system, you're going to get different patterns of campaigning. Yeah. And neither I nor anybody else can really predict exactly what that would look like. Would there be some focus on the large populist media areas? Yes, I think that's true. But I think that campaigns would evolve strategies to reach out broadly. You know, after all, we are not a country that has two big metropolitan areas and the rest is thinly populated, rural America. We have a great many medium-sized cities. And I think that any candidate to win a national election would be wanting to target their campaign at a variety of different places.
Yeah, and of course, and a big criticism of the Electoral College is it gives voters in very sparsely populated states huge influence relative to voters, say, in New York or California, right? A voter in Wyoming, I forget what the figure is, but it's a factor of 5, 6, or 7 times the clout of a voter in a state like New York.
Absolutely. I mean, the Electoral College does not conform to the principle of one person, one vote, which is what we all tend to think of as a basic democratic principle. I mean, that's the way virtually every other election in the United States, from governorships to student council presidents, are conducted.
Yeah. So if we get to the point, and as we mentioned in the introduction, second time in 16 years where someone has lost the popular vote but been able to win the Electoral College, George W. Bush did it in 2000 against Al Gore. Is this an argument in favor of doing away with the Electoral College? And if it is there a chant? What would it take to do away with the Electoral College?
Well, I think it is an argument in favor of getting rid of the Electoral College. And there's another little statistic that I like, which is that in addition to the 5 times when the winner of the popular vote has not become president, has lost the electoral vote, there have been 17 other occasions in U.S. history when a shift of 75,000 votes or less would have created another example of the popular vote winner not being the Electoral College winner. So I think, yes, this is an argument. We also have to remember that in 2004, it almost happened the other way around. George Bush won the popular vote by 3 million votes and 60,000 votes changing in Ohio, and John Kerry would have been president.
That's right. Yeah, we waited until the day after the election for that one to be determined. We hadn't figured it out yet.
Exactly. Yeah, so right. so that's really 3 out of the last 5 have been kind of funky in this score. There are the primary way in which to change the Electoral College, the fundamental way is to amend the Constitution, and I think that will have to be the ultimate solution. It's an arduous process. It requires supermajorities in Congress and by the states. There is a movement afoot, and indeed well along the way, to create an interstate compact. It's called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which in effect says that this compact will take effect when states with 270 electoral votes sign on to it. And at that point, it pledges all the states that have signed on to it to cast their electoral votes for the candidate who wins the national popular vote. Massachusetts has agreed to this compact, by the way. So, 10 states and the District of Columbia have signed on with 165 electoral votes. So that's another strategy. My own view of this is that I think that that's a good strategy to build popular support and to build support within the states and to build political pressure. An interstate compact itself as a long-term solution seems a little unstable and a little rickety, but I think if we could use it to build towards an amendment process.
Well, Alexander Kasar is professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, talking there about some of the intricacies and the history of the Electoral College. His newest book, by the way, Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College, will be published next year. Alex Kasar, thanks so much for coming in. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Anthony.
We've talked before on this show about the disparities between male and female physicians. For instance, at medical schools, there are many fewer female full professors than male professors. And that proportion hasn't changed in more than 30 years. We also know that female physicians earn much less than male physicians.
We find that women actually make about $20,000 less than male physicians within these public university medical schools.
That's Anna Pomgena, an associate professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School. We spoke to him last year. But it's not just the pay that's different. A new Harvard study released just today suggests that female physicians actually get better health results than their male colleagues. With us to talk about the study is Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. She joins us every Monday just about. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Anthony.
So tell us about the study. It sounds to me like we should all be looking for female doctors if we want the best health outcomes.
No, that would be taking it way, way too far.
But all right, well, tell us about the study.
So it's a very provocative study because you know how there's the old feminist slogan, equal pay for equal work?
Right.
Well, so this study suggests that maybe female physicians should be asking for equal pay for better work, because what the study found is that at least among elderly Medicare patients in hospitals, female doctors did tend to get somewhat better results. Their patients tended to live longer and they tended to land back in the hospital less quickly, less often.
Well, that sounds really significant. So what did the study actually look at?
So it was a great big data analysis of records on more than 1.5 million hospitalizations of Medicare patients, so over 65, over 4 years. And it included more than 58,000 doctors, of whom about one-third were women. So it looked at 30-day mortality. In other words, did the patient die within 30 mm-hmm. days? And also readmissions, like did they land right back in the hospital?
Right. And so what were the sort of some of the top lines from the study?
So the main thing they found is that the female doctors did a little better than the male doctors. So, for example, on that 30-day mortality, the female doctors were 11.07% compared to 11.49% for the males. And similarly, there was about that one half of one percentage point gap on landing back in the hospital. And now that might not sound like that much, right? But the researchers projected out that gap for the general population. Here's senior author Dr. Ashish Jha of the Harvard Chan School of Public Health.
We found that, you know, if male physicians achieved the same outcomes as female physicians, that would lead to about 32,000 fewer deaths every year. That's about the number of people who die in motor vehicle accidents.
Wow, so significant.
Yeah. And now, Anthony, I suspect you might want to be rising in defense of males at this moment.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I do want to understand where they could be going wrong or doing things differently. I mean, did the study look at what male doctors might be doing differently from female doctors, for example?
So it did not look at that. That was beyond the scope of this study. But there's been research done on it in the past, and it's found that I'd sum it up as female doctors are kind of less cowboyish than male doctors. They're likelier to follow clinical guidelines and the evidence-based medicine. Dr. Jha says there's also some evidence from other industries, actually, that men tend to be more likely to take risks, which could explain why the benefit of having a female doctor seems to be especially pronounced for sicker patients. And also, research finds that female doctors tend to be more effective at communicating with patients.
I'm curious to know if it's possible that this difference might be explained, at least in part, by the fact that male doctors and female doctors might be attracting different kinds of patients? Was that looked at?
Right, because like you might have a choice, right, in which doctor you go to. And the Harvard researchers were very concerned about that, and they tried every which way to control for it. And in particular, one angle was that they looked at hospitalists. These are doctors who work in hospitals on shifts, so they really don't get to pick their patients, and the patients don't get to pick them. They're pretty much randomly assigned depending on when they work and when the patient comes in. And the effects were consistent. So even though one study is only ever just one study, it's not definitive, but still the researchers were pretty confident that these findings are real.
Real and significant, especially given this pay gap that we mentioned earlier.
Right. And in the debate over that pay gap, there have been some suggestions that, well, you know, maybe female physicians are paid less because their work is somehow less valuable or not as good. Here's Dr. Rita Redberg. She's the editor of JAMA Internal Medicine, which is the journal where the study appeared.
Some of the reasons that have been given as rationalizations for those differences are that the quality of women's work was, for reasons related to childbearing or more likely to work part-time, was lower. And so certainly this study goes a long way to dispelling that rationalization.
Hmm. Now, Carrie, the study looks specifically at people over 65 in hospitals. Now, explain the significance of that.
Well, I mean, for me, I thought it could be particularly reassuring to older patients, because if you're 65 or older, you grew up in a time when there were very few women doctors. And of course, that's shifting rapidly now. About a third of doctors are now women, and a half of medical students are women. So if you're older and you're still in some way kind of uncomfortable with having a female doctor, maybe this big data could help, because it's saying, look, she's probably not only just as good as a man, she might even be better.
So older, anxious patients can feel a little more confident. But I think what would make most female doctors feel better is addressing that pay gap.
Right, for the pay gap to go away. And also, they could probably use more research, both on salaries and on performance. But you're right. In addition, there is a possibility that this issue will kind of self-correct as the structure of American healthcare changes, and doctors are increasingly being paid for the results they get in their patients. Here's Dr. Anna Parks. She's an editorial fellow at the journal JAMA Internal Medicine.
Our hope would be that as we shift our system towards pay for performance, that if those were behaviors that were rewarded with either pay or advancement, that that might help address some of the gaps that still exist.
So in other words, Anthony, it might be instead of just equal pay for equal work, it could be equal pay for equal results, or maybe even better pay for better results.
Imagine
for the women.
That.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And maybe eventually female physicians will actually be routinely earning more than their male colleagues.
Well, if that happens, we'll certainly be talking about it with you in the coming years.
I'll see you there.
All right. Carrie Goldberg is the host of WBUR's Common Health blog. And you can find a link to the study that we were talking about on our website, radioboston.org. Carrie, thanks.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll look at new research from Harvard showing that fewer people than ever are making more money than their parents. It's about the fading American dream. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. If the American dream means attaining a higher standard of living than your parents, then that dream is in trouble. Consider Josh Schatzer, a 38-year-old who works in manufacturing in Indianapolis, who was profiled recently on CBS. Schatzer makes less than half what his dad made and says the possibility of ever doing better than his parents is virtually impossible.
I think it's a dream, and I think it's going to be a very hard dream to make a reality. It's a lot more harder to reach that reality than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Now, Schatzer is right about that, according to new research from economists at Harvard and Stanford universities. They took a look at tax records going back decades and discovered this startling fact. In 1940, a child born into an average American household had a 92% chance of making more money than his parents. Today, only about half of Americans can expect to out-earn their parents. Nathaniel Hendren is an assistant professor of economics at Harvard University and was one of the lead researchers of the study, The Fading American Dream, and he joins us now. And Professor Hendren, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, you can find a link to this paper that we're going to be talking about at radioboston.org. So, Nathaniel, I want to talk about this drop, which is really significant. 92% chance of earning more than your parents down to a 51% chance. Can you sketch out that trend over time? I mean, have the chances of being better off than your parents been falling consistently ever since 1940?
Yeah, so it has been a fairly steady decline over the last four decades, a bit of a steeper decline for people born between 1940 and 1960, and then a continued but perhaps more gradual decline since 1960. So for kids born in 1960, about 60% of those kids grew up to earn more than their parents, and today we think it's about 50%, as you were saying. So the decline was a little bit steeper between people born in 1940 to 1960, and then a little flatter between 1960 and, say, kids born in 1980.
There's so much interesting information in the study, and I have to say that it's represented really powerfully powerfully graphically. If listeners go to RadioBoston.org and click on the study, I mean, Nathaniel, one of the things that I was struck by is just looking at the trajectory of these lines. I mean, they just plummet toward the ground in terms of probability of being able to earn more than your parents as the years progress, right?
Yeah. You know, I can recall the first time that we were able to actually construct this graph, and it kind of took us aback. I think we had a sense that with the kind of stagnation of median wages in the U.S. that we probably were experiencing a bit of a decline. But certainly I don't think we had a sense of the magnitude. I don't think we knew that 90% of kids born in 1940 grew up to actually earn more than their parents, that it really was that kind of widespread, the fraction of people that were earning more than their parents.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting to note that this definitely isn't a question of the country being less productive. In fact, according to your research and other studies that I've read, we're more productive than ever. The challenge here is that the way the growth is being shared and the way that's changing over time, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I think in order for people to earn more than their parents, you know, you need to have an expanding economy. But as you're saying, one of the key things that you need is you need it to be broadly shared economic growth. And so one of the things we do in the work is try to split out kind of the role of just a kind of growing pie versus the way in which that pie is being allocated. And it is true that we've had a slowing down of economic growth since kind of the heyday of kind of the 40s, 50s, and 60s and the post-war economy. But we still have reasonable economic growth today. But what has also changed is the way that growth is allocated. Back in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, growth was broadly shared across the income distribution. Today, there's a greater share of that income that grows to the top regions of the income distribution. And, you know, to the extent to which people that are in the top regions of the income distribution experience more growth, that doesn't actually improve the fraction of kids earning more than their parents, because most of those kids would already be earning more than their parents to begin with.
Mm. Now, you ran some interesting simulations. In one of them, you recreated the last several decades with the same economic growth, the same growth in GDP, but without the post-1970 rise in inequality. So what did you find? First of all, why did you want to do that simulation, and what did you find?
Yeah, so broadly, we wanted to separate out the role of slower economic growth in kind of inhibiting the fraction of kids earning more than their parents versus the way in which that growth is allocated. So as you were mentioning, we do kind of two different simulations. First, we imagine that we have the same growth that we experienced back a generation ago, but we allow that growth to be allocated across the income distribution in the way it is today. And we show that this would increase the fraction of kids earning more than their parents from 50% to 60%, but it doesn't get as close back to the 90% we were experiencing in the past. So we also do another exercise where we say, okay, well, let's imagine that we have the same economic growth that we have today, but we imagine that it's allocated across the income distribution how it was to our parents' generation. And what we show is if you had that allocation of growth, then 80% of kids today would be earning more than their parents.
Wow. So what are the biggest reasons, the biggest drivers for this lack of more even distribution across the population for these results?
So that's what's the underlying kind of drivers of the increased inequality that we're seeing in the U.S.? I think that's a tough question that we really don't have that we don't shed light on in this work. I think it is interesting to note that the way in which growth is allocated across the income distribution is unique to the U.S. There's been some interesting work lately noting that the way in which growth has been unequally allocated across the income distribution is something that is a uniquely American phenomenon.
So another question that I think you do get at, and that is, who is affected most by this trend of making less than your parents? In other words, does it affect everyone in the U.S., or are there particular demographic groups or even different regions that are affected more than others?
Yeah. So we look along two different dimensions. So one is kids of different parental income backgrounds, and the other is of kids that are born in different areas of the country. And broadly, I think the kind of overarching theme is that this decline in the fraction of kids earning more than their parents is something that is experienced across all range of backgrounds. Kids from all different parental income backgrounds are less likely to earn more than their parents than they were in the past. And kids that grow up in different areas of the country are less likely to earn more than their parents than they were in the past. But as you note, there are some areas of the country that have experienced greater declines than other areas of the country. So places like Massachusetts have experienced a smaller decline than places like Michigan. So it used to be that if you were born in Michigan, you had a higher chance of earning more than your parents than if you were born in Massachusetts. And today, that's flipped. 55% of kids grow up to earn more than their parents in Massachusetts, whereas 46% of kids grow up to earn more than their parents in Michigan.
Yeah. And one of the big it's interesting that you mentioned Massachusetts and Michigan and how that has flipped, because once upon a time, of course, Michigan, a robust center of manufacturing and all that kind of stuff, and Massachusetts today, of course, very high levels of college completion rate, much lower in Michigan. Do we assume that there's some connection there?
Yeah. So broadly, when we look across the U.S. and we understand, you know, what are the characteristics of places that are promoting more upward mobility, we do see things that are rooted in kids' childhood experiences. And what we've shown in some other work is that places that tend to have kind of more social capital, stronger quality schools, stronger family structures, less residential segregation, and less income inequality are all places that tend to promote greater outcomes for kids, and today have a higher fraction of kids earning more than their parents, relative to places that don't have as much of those characteristics.
Interesting. So, I mean, this leads to questions, especially we've just come off an election year and in a very sort of volatile election year. But what are the policy implications of this study, in your view?
Well, I think, you know, whenever one starts to move towards policy implications, there's always sorts of different things to bring into consideration. I think the one thing that we want to highlight with this work is that I think it suggests a role for thinking about a different rationale for promoting policies that promote broadly shared economic growth. I think there's a lot of discussion about let's get policies that are going to increase economic growth, and some people don't like to talk about whether or not that growth is broadly shared or not. What our results suggest is that unless you have broadly shared economic growth, you're really not going to move the needle on the fraction of kids earning more than their parents, that the way in which growth has been allocated in recent decades has really caused a plummeting of the fraction of kids earning more than their parents. So if that's a statistic you care about, then you have to care about the growth that's broadly shared across the income distribution.
Yeah. So when it comes to, for example, I mean, let's talk about what we heard President-elect Donald Trump talk about during the campaign. He talked about wanting to increase economic growth in a way to help more Americans earn more, though he wasn't hugely specific. But is focusing on higher, or if I'm understanding you correctly, just focusing on higher GDP as a solution isn't necessarily going to do it if we don't also focus on ways to broadly distribute that economic growth.
That's right. Yeah. So you could imagine, even suppose we get the growth, the GDP growth rate up to 6%. We think that unless you change the way growth is allocated, that's only going to cause about 60% of kids to grow up to earn more than their parents. So you're really not coming anywhere close to the historical rates of upward mobility that we've experienced. But in contrast, if you took the same amount of growth and just allocated it in a way that is more common in the past in the U.S., you could see rates of upward mobility of 80%.
Yeah. This election was marked by enormous levels of distrust of government, social institutions. To what extent do you think this sort of disappearing part of the American dream contributes to that? I mean, I think this gets sort of beyond the sort of scope of your study, but as someone who has looked at and digested all of this research, I'm sure you've got some thoughts about that.
Yeah. I think what has struck us, and this comes back to your question earlier about who has shared in this decline in upward mobility, and that it's about that it's consistent across kids of different backgrounds. So both rich and poor kids have shared in this decline of the fraction of those kids that grow up to earn more than their parents. And I think that kind of spoke to, at least to me, about why, and in some sense, you saw messages from both sides of the aisle about this kind of seeming loss of the American dream. And I think that sort of potentially resonates with sort of what we are as a country experiencing in terms of this particular notion of our social fabric, and something that I think is important to a lot of people.
Yeah. Finally, I want to ask you just about the opportunities that exist for people to climb that ladder. And here I'm talking about climbing that ladder out of poverty. I think I found a quote from you somewhere in preparing for this segment where you talked about these rungs getting farther and farther apart. That is much more difficult for that to access that upward that path of upward mobility.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think there's a lot of kind of ways of thinking about this. But when you look across the United States, what you see is places where there is a greater degree of income inequality. Those are places where kids from low-income backgrounds have a much harder time coming up out of poverty. And so there's a lot of ways in which promoting broadly shared economic growth can have added benefits, not only to improving the overall fraction of people who are earning more than their parents, but also as promoting outcomes for kids of disadvantaged backgrounds.
Well, that's Nathaniel Hendren. He's a assistant professor of economics at Harvard University, a faculty research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and co-author of the new paper, The Fading American Dream: Trends in Absolute Income Mobility Since 1940. Nathaniel Hendren, thank you so much for joining us. It's a fascinating study and an important one, and I'm very grateful to you.
Well, thanks for having me.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, Shakespeare and hip-hop combine at the Boston Public Library. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The Boston Public Library has been honoring the 400th anniversary of William Shakespeare's death with exhibitions of rare first and early editions of many of his plays. The BPL, which holds a vast Shakespeare collection, says the exhibit, Shakespeare Unauthorized, makes the Bard's world come alive. Part of Shakespeare Unauthorized includes a high-energy literary show from hip-hop poet and actor Marlon Carey and slam poetry champion and educator Reggie Gibson. Every month, they combine poetry, spoken word, song, rap, jazz, funk, and country music to create Shakespeare to hip-hop, which makes the Bard's words really come alive. And Marlon Carey and Reggie Gibson join us now, along with their bassist, Allison Keslow. And all three of you, welcome. Marlon, Reggie, great to see you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
It's really fun. I love this subject. And Reggie Gibson, you've been on the show. You've been on the show a couple of times.
Yes.
But tell us what, and either one of you just jump in here, what is Shakespeare to hip hop? What are you trying to do here?
Well, we're bringing together the root and the fruit of the literature that we love, Shakespeare being the person who's given us so many words and phrases to play with, over 3,000, I think, was the last count. And we see that hip-hop also gives us a lot of words and phrases that enter into the American lexicon. And what we're hoping to do, and what we have been doing, is combining what we find in Shakespeare, about his love, his life, his the mysteries that were surrounding his life, and what we love about hip-hop, which is wordplay and a little bit of humor and all of that, and bringing all of that together so that people can have a good time with both.
Yeah, I mean, years ago, Reggie and I started sort of sharing, performances. I have a school. It's a really large performance. I'd like to have someone come along with me, or we need help. We do workshops. And I would call him in, and he'd call me in. And so we started, four years ago, decided to create something and call it something. We originally wanted to call it Homer to Hip Hop. But when you search Homer on the internet, you find about 60-70% of it is Homer Simpson. We didn't want to get muddled into that, so we thought Shakespeare to hip-hop had a more poetic sound. And so really, people have been asking us over this course of the last couple of years, do you have a set that does just that. Yeah. Shakespeare and hip-hop, Bridge to Gap, modern to classic to modern. And we, this year with the BPL, we really have created that, we believe.
Well, I'd love to give our listeners a flavor of what you guys do. So do you want to just sort of pick a part of one of the numbers that you do and just explain it and just go right into it?
Sure. Well, both of our... all of our children love to watch reruns of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And they're always...
Which, of course, makes us all think of Shakespeare.
Of course! And so Marla and I, we was thinking, well, you know, we need something biographical that talks about a person moving from one place to another.
Right.
And so Marla said, well, hey, I can talk about Stratford-upon-Avon, which is where Shakespeare was born, and about him being there and him moving to London. And so this is, I guess, part of that, part of what we call the Stratford rap, and it's done to the basics of the... Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Okay, here we go. Reggie Gibson and Marlon Carey, Allison Keslow and bass.
Now this is the story all about how one man turned the whole world upside down. And if you'd like to hear it, just sit right there. I tell you how it came to be known as the great William Shakespeare. In Stratford-upon-Avon, born and raised in the glove shop where he spent most of his days, helping his daddy raise sheep for the war when all reading some books at the King's New School. Mom and Dad, John and Mary, they were doing pretty good. His pop was the mayor of the neighborhood. They had eight children total, just to keep it fair, but only one became the famous William Shakespeare. He had to learn Latin and poets like Ovid, Virgil, and Plutarch. He simply loved it. He lived during the time of the bubonic plague. Many people died, they could not be saved, but Shakespeare survived somehow, some way, and the 18 years old married Anne Hathaway.
All right. Reggie Gibson and Marlon Carey, we're talking with the co-creators of Shakespeare to Hip Hop. That's part of a program over the Boston Public Library.
Oh, yeah.
Shakespeare Unauthorized.
Shakespeare Unauthorized, right, which marks the 400th anniversary of the Bard's death.
Yes.
Fantastic. Now, I understand that you guys have two characters that you embody or perform as during the show. Reggie, you're Robin Hood's fellow.
Yes, I am Robin Hood fellow, and everything that is attendant to that name. Every funny thing you can think about is what that is. Robin Hood fellow.
All right. And Marlon, you're Horatio Everyman.
I'm Horatio Everyman, yes.
Right. So do you want to talk a little bit about these characters and how they interact with each other?
Well, a lot like we do, I suppose. you know, we like to joke a little bit and talk a little crazy to each other sometimes. We help each other out with our respective words. Robin Hoodfellow is a person who, of course, is from Robin Goodfellow, who was Puck. Who was the Puck in A Midsummer Night's Dream. But also there's Robin Hood, who takes from the those who have and gives to those who don't. Yeah. So I saw myself as a person who's taking from the richness that Shakespeare has given us and giving that, bringing that to people who might be Shakespeare impoverished.
Right.
And that's part of why I adopted that character.
I see. And Horatio Everyman?
And so Robin Hoodfellow sort of knows everything, is more hip to all that. He's sort of a guy around town.
Yeah.
And Horatio Everyman is more of a lot of the material I've been sort of trying to create for this is really trying to attract, you know, the average individual who doesn't know a lot about Shakespeare, who might know a little bit and be intrigued. And so Horatio Everyman for me represents sort of the everyman, the person who, you know, knows a little bit about it. He's been around, but it's learning more as you go along. The part that is intrigued by Shakespeare and wants to know more.
I see. So how do you guys, I mean, can you give us an example of sort of how are these two characters interact? I mean,
We're the guides. We're the guides on this show. So we essentially look at them as time travelers.
I see.
Right.
Because there are times when we talk about how, for instance, Shakespeare's life wasn't as documented as ours is with the texting and the internet. You know, every minute you're tweeting something.
Right.
That, how would they have that knowledge if they weren't sort of traveling along the timeline? So that's sort of one way.
And quickly, we do use a text which will be found on the wall of the Globe if people go there. It's by, Mr. Levin.
Bernard
Levin. He wrote a piece called You're Quoting Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And so we use a little jazz to sort of talk about that. And we go back and forth with that. So it's, you know.
And this is the idea that you're quoting Shakespeare. There's a lot of sort of references in the language that we use today. Even if you don't know Shakespeare, it's like, hey,
you've heard
it's all
phrase.
Greek to me. You're quoting Shakespeare.
You're quoting Julius Caesar.
Right.
Or as I was mentioning earlier, that if someone says, I'm more sinned against than sinning, right? People would think, of course, because of the religious language in that, that might be from the Bible, but it's not. It's actually from King Lear.
Yeah, very interesting. Great. Now, part of the mission at the Boston Public Library is to attract and connect with younger audiences,
yes.
Right? So who's coming to your shows? I mean, how are you trying to do that?
We've been getting a lot of, we would say, 30 and ups who are also there, who are people who are frequenting the libraries at that time. We go to the rooms where the teenagers are, and we bring them down. We physically go to people in the library and say, come check this show out. And of course, we show up in full Elizabethan gear.
Yeah.
So people want to see what's going to happen. And they typically show up, and they just come. And then some people hear the music, and next thing you know, it's like we've got, you know, fifth graders when we do our library shows. We do branch shows as well, not just a BPL. Branch shows. And there are a bunch of fifth graders who are rocking out
to
Shakespeare. And then we also have octogenarians who've been to the BPL to see us. So it's a full range of people who show up.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Now, one of the bits that you guys do are smackdowns between famous Shakespearean characters.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh,
now,
yeah.
Now, I understand you've prepared one of them for us. But first, give us a sense of what you mean here by a smackdown.
You want to talk about this?
As part of hip-hop, it has this history also of the MC battles. And so some of that has to survive in different forms. So we find that young people are attracted to these. Some of what happened in slam poetry gets sort of misinterpreted as that, but sort of it's the rap battle. So this is a smackdown where Shakespearean characters...
Who are villains.
Who are, in this particular case, we have Lady Macbeth
and Iago.
Like, who's the worst villain? So we take a different spin off of the battle rap or the smackdown.
Right. It's not how come I'm better than you. It's how come you're worse than me.
Yeah, you're the
worst. This is why you're worse than me. And we have the crowd judge it, of course. And so this is... You'd like us to do one?
Absolutely.
Okay, so Marlon is going to play Iago. I'm
going
to play Lady Macbeth. And for those who know the play, they'll get it. You know, Iago's just a bad, bad man. And Lady Macbeth is sweetness and light. So
no, not at all. But,
so
the smackdown begins.
There it is. Shall we, sir?
We shall. Well, if it isn't Lady Macbeth, I must confess I'm not impressed with you yet. Maybe if you had a few more speaking lines. That wasn't under my breath. Oh, what's this? I think you missed the spot. You should have worn gloves. You have got the heart of a raven with the face of a dove. Alas, poor Lord Macbeth, he sure did pick a winner. Remind me never to accept your invitation for dinner. Invite a fellow to dine, then put death on the menu. No lawyer in their right mind would ever defend you. Let me go a little further while the cat's out of the bag. You could have been one of the witches on the heath, because you're a crazy old hag, always scheming and plotting in the corners, lurking. The crystal ball says your future is murky. Lady Macbeth, I can regret that you're not going to get this championship. I'll sink that battleship. Your mind slipped while you slept, sleepwalker. The dark side is strong with this one. You're a certified maker of innocent victims.
Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts. There's a knave in my face, and I like it not. For I am vexed by the essence that his presence has brought. Please send me a cleanser to rout out this here spot. I am not your wife Amelia, Juliet, or Cordelia. I'm a real woman, Cinnamon, so I ain't fearing you. Yes, I know how to use a dagger, and I got that diva swagger like Athena. And I can see you've never seen her had to deal with a woman of will, who will get in your grill and spill all over you the way she truly feels. The way I feel is you make me ill, you motiveless malignant menace. I'm the queen of Scotland while you're the something that's rotten in Venice, whining and crying about not being promoted. At over 1,000 lines, your vocabulary's bloated. It should be noted, yes, I only get 259 lines. That's because men waste words and time while we're women use our minds.
Reggie Gibson channeling Lady Macbeth there, and Marlon Carey channeling Iago in a smackdown part of Shakespeare to hip-hop at the Boston Public Library. That's fantastic. You know, it seems like one of the... Reggie, I want to ask you about this because
sure.
We've been lucky to have you on the show a couple of times in the past, and the last time you joined us, it was right after you spoke at TEDx Boston,
yes.
And you brought the audience to its feet with your performance of an original poem called Cry Havoc to Thine Own Self, Be Hip.
Yes.
And it was a response to Hamlet's existential question for men who have considered suicide.
Yes.
It was a powerful, powerful thing, but the point that was most powerful was the way you were using Shakespeare allusions to speak to younger people, right?
Yes.
And why, I mean, why does that work so well, in your view?
Well, I think that many young people need to understand that they're not going through those things alone, and that there is context and there is history, and that we as a species have been dealing with these things for so long that we've created characters that basically carry the weight of the weight that we're carrying. And we can look at how these characters get together and how they work it out or how they don't work it out. I used to work with another group that was called Changing Lives Through Literature that understood that there were a lot of young people who were incarcerated who also did not have good role models. And so we would come in and we would read, they would read books, and we would look at the characters in the books to be the role models that they did not have. So it's this understanding that literature can give you something that your real life might not be able to provide for you. Mm. And Shakespeare spoke to me as a young man, and continue to. And I found that with that piece that you mentioned, Cry Havoc, that it was speaking to my 8-year-old son. And once he understood what Hamlet was saying, he memorized the words to the soliloquy, and it's been with him ever since, and he's 15 years old now.
Well, I'm pretty sure we have a link to that piece at RadioBoston.org with the rest of the information about this. Reggie Gibson, educator, slam poetry champion, and Marlon Carey is a literary performance artist, and you can catch them the first Friday of every month at the Boston Public Library performing their original material in Shakespeare to Hip Hop as part of the exhibit Shakespeare Unauthorized. There's more information at RadioBoston.org. And gentlemen, thank you so much for coming in. I really, really appreciate it.
And thank you for having us.
Thank you for having me.
And Allison Keslow on bass, thank you as well.
Absolutely.
And that's it for today. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. And we had help today from Caitlin O'Keefe, Virginia Marshall, and Cassandra Sunt. Tim Skog is our technical director. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
All this city is a stage, wherein and upon we engage to play out this melodramatic sitcom that is life in Boston, where we alternate between smile and strife, triumph and trap, where we hapless hacks script the action. Action! Into the bottomless procession of bottoms trotting around downtown, their donkeys' heads braying, praying to convince us they have the status of stallions. Enter the battalions of rapscallions, those ill-eyed Iagos who, like witches around a bubbling cauldron, concoct a poison to pour into the ear and the mind. All this city is a stage, and you won't have to wait long before you find that so good, so good, so good, charming song by the disarming Falstaffian laugh-hearted wretches who are football jerseyed, baseball capped, gore-bellied, and jolly jowled as Daddy Christmas. And then there's no way to miss those gifted, lean, and hungry-looking 20-somethings getting attired in the tiring room, standing standby, waiting in the wings, rehearsing their monologues, readying to hog the scene once they get their cue. Just do a walkthrough and dig and check the Juliet on the third-floor balcony. See how she smiles as she muses about that skinny jean Romeo, the one over there brooding with the black id on his shoulder. See how he watches her gently alight her hand on her cheek. Watch him open his mouth as if to speak, yet says nothing, because he decides to send a text instead. Shh. Hey, don't disturb the PhD candidates, those poor Hamlet-like ditherers who can't get out of their own heads. Every day you can watch them bother wicked smart librarians, those bibliophilic antiquarians who with Job-like patience attend to their whims by delving into the musty dust-pregnant pages of forgotten books. And look, there, it's the Tower of Brains. How it rises above the surrounding scenery, how its red brick facade sets off beautifully against the manicured greenery. If you lean in and listen attentively, you can hear the undergraduate inmates screaming as they are upended and suspended by their young and tender uncalloused heels before being slowly turned on collegiate wheels and broken upon professorial racks. Don't drink from that. That's the Charles River, man. The ever brown. Steeping like tea as it meanders around and down to the sea, and it too, like Thames and the Avon, has watered many a word and song from many a busker and bard. Then there are those poor Prosperos, the politicos, who deign to direct this company of Calibans. We, the capricious cast and crew who elect them to keep this production up and running. The ones we are always gunning for and kind of, sort of, almost adore, as long as the box office is busy and the take is fat.
The truth is that they are more like the wranglers of cats, trying to keep us from scratching up the inherited furniture. All the city is a stage. Political stage left. Political stage right. Some at political center stage, playing in the red and the blue footlights. Some downstage, nearer the groundlings, where the stench gets so bad it tears the eyes and gags the mouth. Ah, the funk and chronic halitosis that is the open house. But like always, this rank stank will eventually waft its way upstage, up to the hill, up to the cushioned balconies. All this city is a stage, and well, we are all actors, I suppose, all playing our roles, singing our solos in a chorus of voices sometimes gone hoarse in the course of trying to be heard, saying lines that will last as long as men can breathe or eyes can see. So slow down, revel in the scene. Take a little time to spy each face whose sweat, work, toil, and failed dream is the oil, steam, spark, and grace that keeps this whole spectacle crackling and shining. So go now, pray you. Go into this city, into this unsceptered cockpit of a commonwealth that tries to hold the vasty fields of us all. For all this city is a stage, and tonight the theater is packed tight. The audience awaits you with bated breath. So take your place in the spotlight. And oh yes, break a leg.